97.5 The Fanatic.
Hope you're staying safe and happy and healthy, and welcome into 97.5 The Fanatic. The number, as always, to join the conversation is 610-632-0975. Tyler Zuli. We're broadcasting live from the Parks Race and Sportsbook here inside Chickie and Pete's in Malvern. We're here until 3 o'clock today. Come on down and say hello. Love to see you. Love to spend some time with you. Mike Vito back at our Bala Kenwood Studios today. He's producing the show. We'll hear from him in just a moment. We have a lot to get into, including this fly that continues to get around my head. We're going to get the fly by the end of the show, I promise. Either that or a microphone stand is going to get thrown. Anyway, we're here until 3 o'clock today. We have a three-hour run and a ton to get into. So why don't we jump right into things? I've said for the better part of, 3 months now, that you should remain grounded, that you should remain based when it comes to the Phillies. Ups, downs, ins, outs, winning streaks, losing streaks, winning a series, losing a series, sweeping a series, getting swept in a series. All of these things are cyclical when it comes to sports. All of these things are extra cyclical when it comes to baseball. It's a long season. There is a time for celebration. There is a time for being annoyed. And all of those things are fair throughout the season. But I do urge, and I have urged for a long time now, to stay based as a Phillies fan. Because if you ride a baseball season the way that you ride a football season, you're going to be emotionally drained by the end of the summer. You're going to be worn out by the end of the summer. And I think that that's a really good way to approach things when it comes to a baseball season. 162 games, 50-plus series, some two, some three, some four-game series. And that's kind of the best way to stay grounded in the roots of a season without getting emotionally too high or too low. It becomes difficult to do that when you have a stretch like you've had over the last five games. It becomes difficult to do that when you win the first two games of a series against a team that you're going to be battling for playoff contention with all season long in the St. Louis Cardinals. You're on this emotional high. And then you lose the next two. You lose the next two to the Cardinals, and yes, you've split the series, and yes, you won the season series, and yes, that is something that we can get excited about, the fact that you now own a tiebreaker over a team that you might need it down the stretch, but the ground that you gained over the first two games is immediately lost in the next two. Then you have the entire situation with the Toronto Blue Jays and going up to Toronto and not playing at full strength, and we know why, and we don't need to discuss it again, but you understand the availability factor was an issue. And they get swept in two games. And now you're staring at a four-game losing streak. And what I saw across social media was puzzling to me, was pondering to me. It felt like there was a jump right back to a doom and gloom scenario. It felt like there was a jump right back to same old Phillies. They're right back to where we thought they were going to be. This is what was waiting for the other shoe to drop. And it kind of surprised me. It kind of surprised me because of the fact that we looked at this team since Rob Thompson became the interim manager. And we looked at this team and said, series sweep over the Angels. Series sweep over the Brewers. Series win over this team. Series win over that team. Winning 4 out of 5 against the Nationals. Winning 2 out of 3 against the Marlins. A team that for the last couple of seasons, this team has struggled against. And we were on that emotional high of the Chunas train, the roller coaster, whatever you want to call it. We were riding that high. And that was over the span of multiple weeks. That was over the span of 6-7 series, 8 series, 9 series, a series win against the Cardinals earlier in the month. The slip-up against the Texas Rangers, a series loss to the Braves. But for the most part, this team has been playing really good baseball over the last month and a half. So it's a little bit strange to me that I saw a lot of downward deflection of this team because of the four-game stretch. Was it ideal? Absolutely not. I understand that the frustrations mount when you win two in a row to start a series. You don't get a series victory. You don't have your full capacity of players because of, you know, having to go play in Toronto. And they mount and you have a four-game losing streak. But last night is the reason as to why I try to keep a base. Last night is the reason why I try to keep you grounded and not get overly concerned over the fact that the Phillies lost four in a row. Did they lose ground? They lost ground, yes. Did they have a multi-game lead in the wild card and now they no longer have said multi-game lead in the wild card? Yes. There's no doubt about it. However, last night is the reason why you stay grounded in a long season. Because if you were to say to me at the beginning of this series, still with two games left, obviously, still now with two opportunities to take two out of three and win another divisional series against the team that you have struggled against over the last couple of years, if you would have said to me, what is the surest outcome? What is the quickest way, the most plausible, likely scenario in which the Phillies win two out of three against the Marlins in this series? It would be to win games two and game three. The Phillies are going up, or went up against last night, perhaps the best pitcher in baseball this season in Sandy Alcantara. Sandy Alcantara has been absolutely dominant this year. He leads the National League in innings pitched. He has been unbelievable in terms of going deep into contests. Seven innings. I think he now has a stretch of double-digit games in which he's pitched at least seven innings in every single start that he's made. He's been really, really good against the Phillies in general over the last couple of seasons. If you were to have said to me the Phillies are going to win two out of three, I would have told you it's probably going to be on the strength of winning Saturday and Sunday. But here we are Saturday afternoon, Saturday morning, you know, into the early portions of Saturday afternoon, and now they only have to win one of the next two to win this the weekend series. Now they have an opportunity to sweep a series, potentially, that I did not think was going to be afforded to them when you are facing and staring Sandy Alcantara in the face to start a series coming off a four-game losing streak. This is why baseball cannot be that emotional roller coaster that the NFL is, and that we've even made basketball at this point. We as Sixers fans have made the NBA feel like the NFL. And maybe that's a good thing in the sense that we are hyper-focused on individual performances. Maybe that's a good thing in the fact that we feel comfortable discussing Tuesday night losses to the Brooklyn Nets as if they're Game 4 losses to the Miami Heat in the playoffs. And maybe that's just what comes with expectations. And that's great, in a sense. I understand that it's difficult for our psyche, but it's great in a sense that we feel comfortable having that kind of conversation after one loss because we expect big things from the Sixers year in and year out. And while I don't find it feasible to do it over the course of a season, an 82-game season in the NBA or in the NHL, I know that that's closer to the NFL than what Major League Baseball is. If you try to do that over the course of 162 games, I promise you, you are going to be exhausted by the end of the season. And that's why when I look at a four-game losing streak, I can almost parse those into two separate two-game losing streaks because they feel different. The Phillies had an opportunity to win three out of four against the Cardinals. The bullpen blew game three. I'm not going to sit here and blame the bullpen. They've been really, really good this year. But they did have an opportunity to win game three against the St. Louis Cardinals. I look at the two back-end games against the Cardinals as more concerning losses than I do against the Toronto Blue Jays because, let's face it, I went into that series thinking they had no chance. The only chance that they would have had was Zach Wheeler pitching deep into game two, pitching extremely well, and them coming out and finding a way to beat Jose Berríos, who's not been very good this year statistically, but you saw in game two, he was great against the Phillies. That was their only chance at splitting that series. But the likelihood of the situation was this team was not going to compete in that two-game stretch. So while I'm frustrated at the fact that that was an availability thing, I look at that series and I chuck it away. I throw it in the trash and I forget about it. if we can come back to it, we can circle back to it if the Phillies miss the playoffs by a game or they miss the playoffs by two games, because we can use in big, big red pen, even in red Sharpie if you want to. You want to circle those two games in the middle of July and say those were the condemning games. And I'm not a big proponent of that, but the reality of the situation is that's what's going to happen. But I cannot get overly dramatic, overly pessimistic about a four-game skid, because this thing surely could have gotten worse. You could have gone up against Alcantara last night, and yes, they did not produce many runs. They only scored two runs. You cannot feasibly win games consistently scoring two runs. But for last night, and last night only, one of 162, and more specifically, game one of a three-game stretch in Miami to wrap up the first half of the season, I take it one game at a time, and for last night and last night only, it was good enough to get the victory. And so that's why I continue to tell you to remain grounded with this team. This is still a playoff team. They're going to make the playoffs. I say that as a statement of fact, not as a thought, a think piece, not as an opinion, not as a multiple choice question, yes, no, maybe. They're going to make the playoffs. And these are the kind of games that define their season, or are going to continue to define their season, far more than the two-game stretch where you get swept out of the building by the Toronto Blue Jays because you're not at full strength. Again, it's one game. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it is the make-or-break game, but it's the reason as to why we stay calm. It's the reason as to why we stay within a construct for a 162-game schedule. Now, it's going to be on them to win one of these next two games, because if they lose tonight and tomorrow, we'll have a totally different conversation, and everything that I just said will be a moot point. It'll go out the window, and it won't matter. But if they win one of these next two games, they either win tonight or they win tomorrow, and they take two out of three to wrap up the first half of the season with a two out of three series victory over the Marlins in Miami, another divisional victory, series victory that you can just chalk up, it's about as good of a first half as I could ask for, specifically with how poorly they played in the first month and a half of the season. 610-632-0975 is the number to join the conversation. Before we get to the phones, we're going to talk to Dan in Norristown. We're going to talk to Greg in Bethlehem. We're going to speak to you. Let's welcome our second member of today's program back at our Bala Cynwyd studios. That would be our producer today, Mike Vito. First and foremost, Mike, good afternoon. Good to be back with you. Last night, I know that we're not going to, again, we're only going to take it as one game, but I take that as an important bounce-back win over a darn good pitcher, maybe one of the best in the league this season. And I know that I'm only going to take it as a win on face value, but I think that that's the kind of game that you could very well easily lose 1-0, and then this losing streak starts to spiral out of control.
First and foremost, good afternoon to you as well, Tyler. Good to be with you again. Yeah, there's a lot to dive into there with what you started off with, and I echo a lot of the sentiments. That easily could have been a 1-0 loss last night, and it was trending that way. Alcantara, one of the best pitchers, as you said, and I'll agree with you, in baseball, if not just the National League. He came into the game, I was reading an article from Jim Salisbury, he put out on NBC Sports Philadelphia this morning, came into the game with a 19-inning scoreless streak and extended to 25 before we did get to him. But the number that stood out to me is, now we had 28 hits in those four losses. They had no walks for 41 and two-third innings until they got the walk last night, which blew my mind. But you're not getting those extra base runners on base. Hurts because you can't do anything. Yeah, you're getting hits, but you need to mix in walks with that to help along the runners. It could have compounded into a fifth loss last night, but it did not. That's a great win. It's a great momentum builder going into the break. You stopped that four-game losing streak. It could have really spiraled out, like you said, but this team has been grounded a lot ever since Rob Thompson took over this team for Joe Girardi, and we do get caught up in the wins and losses sometimes, and I think people do need to relax and kind of chill out a little bit about it, because it is a 162-game season. So the Eagles, obviously, every game hinges every game. Flyers and Sixers have only an 80-game season, so there's a little bit more impact. 160-game season, we talked about it before. You're going to factor in out of 160 games, 60 wins, 60 losses, no matter what. It's a matter of what you do with those other 40 games. Can you get the 90 wins, 95 wins, put yourself in division, spot to win a division? Yes, it was concerning to lose those games the way you did, but at the same time, you look at what you're up against. Now, granted, you would have expected better from Nola. You expected better from Zach Wheeler against Toronto, but you factor in, all right, Toronto's coming out firing because now they fired the manager. Now they feel like a little bit of it's on them. We got to perform better. And honestly, that's as well as Zach Wheeler's pitched. I'm not upset with that game because I kind of expected. I mean, look what the Phillies did when we came out. We won 9 straight. I mean, the team builds momentum when you fire a manager. It said there's a change there. It provides a spark. And you look at what they did. We went on 9-game winning streak. We won multiple series. We swept back-to-back series. We can't get lost in back-to-back losses. I know it amounted to 4 in a row. But at the same time, you got to take things away from it. I said this is not a team that is obviously under 500. They're not a bad baseball team. They've been hit with injuries, unfortunately. They're still finding ways to overcome the problems and find ways to win games that early in the year or even last year would not have happened. So the fact that they're 47-43 right now, 2 games left to go into the All-Star break, you're playing almost with house money in this weekend series because you figure you're chasing the series coming into today, losing the Alcantara last night. But now you're up 1-0 in the series. You have Nola going tomorrow. You have Suarez coming back today, so you're not sure what you're going to get, especially a kid, which the Phillies notoriously make no-name pitchers, and this kid's going to make his debut today, look like all-star Cy Young caliber pitchers.
7 shutout innings incoming, no doubt.
Sure, I agree with you. I'm sure they'll look like a bleak offense again today, and then maybe get something to go late, but if you can get today's game as well, and you got to feel good with Nola going in, on the mound tomorrow, get your sweep, and you go into the break at 49-43. You're 6 games over 500, and you got a feasible schedule facing you coming out against the Cubs and all.
And here's the thing. I'm going to make this very, very clear right away because I said this last year, and I don't want to sound like I'm just sitting here repeating myself year after year, but it remains factual and it remains true. I don't want to see. I don't want to hear. I don't want to hear about, and I don't want to try to put into the ether that, oh, well, the Phillies have the 4th easiest schedule heading into the second half of the season. I don't care. Do you know why I don't care? Because the Phillies had the 2nd easiest schedule heading into the second half at the All-Star break last year. They had a little bit of a difficult stretch to begin the second half, and then they had stretches going up against the Pirates. They had stretches going up against the Nationals. They had stretches going up against the Marlins. And do you know what they did? They floundered down the stretch. I don't want to hear strength of schedule because I don't buy strength of schedule because baseball is way too fluid of a sport. With that being said, I can get to they need to capitalize on some of the teams that they're facing. And I don't mean like looking 4 months into the future to see how many more times they play Pittsburgh and how many more times they play Cincinnati and how many more times they play the Marlins and the Nationals. That's not what I'm talking about. I mean, when the team is literally directly in front of you, such as the Miami Marlins are currently, you need to take care of what you need to take care of in that 3-game set. So I don't want to hear about, and I don't mean you, Mike. I'm just spewing this because I hate seeing it on social media.
No, it's a sense of the general public. I know.
Right. So I don't want to hear about the 4th easiest schedule. I do not care. You have to take advantage of that schedule in order for it to matter. Because if you don't take advantage of that and you start losing series to Washington, or you start losing series to Pittsburgh, you start losing series to Arizona. And I understand, listen, you're not going to win every single one of the series against the teams that you are quote-unquote better than. That doesn't happen. It's just the fluidity of baseball. But taking advantage of a series that's in front of you is entirely different than saying, well, the next 6 weeks they've got 5 series against teams that are under 500. They should win every one of those. I don't know what's going to happen in 4 weeks. I don't know how they get healthy. When does Ranger Suarez come back? When does Zach Eflin come back? Does Kyle Gibson pitch well like he has in his last 2 starts? Or does Kyle Gibson pitch poorly like he did in the 4 starts previous? All of those things are considerable factors, right? And while I still believe that this is a playoff team, and I say that as a matter of fact, not as an opinion, I still need to see some things get cleaned up. Because there's no doubt that this team is not perfect. They have trades that they need to make. They have players that need to step up in the second half. And while I do believe that this is a playoff team, that's why I'm staying grounded series by series, game by game, because for me, it's the only way to go about things. 610-632-0975 is the number to join the conversation. All right, before we hit the break, let's open up the phone lines. We're going to go to Dan in Norristown up next in the Fanatic. And Mike, if you don't mind, if you could punch Dan up for me. Dan, what's going on?
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Thank you for making the call.
Excellent. Tyler, thank you for taking my call. How are you today?
Doing well. I appreciate you making it.
I understand I don't have a lot of time.
You got time. Go ahead. All right, Mike, if you don't mind, if you can put Dan on hold, we'll check in with him real quick. Having a little bit of technical difficulties here. While we do that, let's go to Greg in Bethlehem up next in the Fanatic. Mike, if you don't mind, I know you're trying to do about seven things at once. Greg, what's going on?
Hey, how you doing, Tyler?
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Good. It was nice to see the Phillies hang in there. I mean, the last night's game was a game that they would have lost in the past. They just...
Sure.
It seems like they get their heads down. They just can't make it happen. But, you know, it's a character builder. And I was glad to see that, you know, against arguably one of the best pitchers in the league. But, you know, my question is, have we seen enough of Mickey Moniak to realize that he's overmatched and they need to replace him at center field? Because he's just, everybody keeps, early in the season, it's like, well, he's getting used to major league pitching.
Right.
Give him some time. Has he had enough time?
In totality, no, I don't. And listen, you're speaking to somebody who does not believe that Mickey Moniak will ever be a contributing major league player. There's nothing that I watch in his plate approaches. There's nothing that I watch in him game by game that I say, you know, that is a usable trait. That is a usable tool that makes me feel comfortable that one day down the stretch, he's going to be a formidable major league center fielder. With that being said, I don't think that he's gotten enough time yet this year to make that ultimatum-type decision, but I also recognize that they are quickly running out of time in order to rectify the situation for this season. You know, if Moniak can be a guy down the stretch, if he can be a guy in 24 and 25, that's fine. And, you know, we'll get to that bridge when we cross it, but right now what I'm trying to do is expedite the chances of winning this year. And
right.
Quite frankly, he does not do that.
Well, I mean, I don't know of anybody that looks more lost at the plate. Honestly, I mean, he just looks lost. I don't know if he's guessing and guessing wrong every time, but you know, all they got to do to get him out is throw the back foot slider or a change up in the dirt. And he's waving at it, and you know, obviously hitting is difficult, but
of course
he looks totally lost.
Yeah, his plate approach is poor. We see a couple guys that on this team right now with a poor plate approach. Obviously, he's not the only one. He to me is a little bit more excusable because of his relative age and relative inexperience compared to guys like Nick Castellanos, whose plate approach has
right.
been, you know, other than. There was like a three-week stretch in the late portions of June, early portions of July, where I thought that his plate approach was getting better. It looked like he was seeing pitches a little bit better. He was letting the at-bat come to him a little bit more, and you know,
right.
instead of diving out over in front of the plate. And then all of a sudden, that stopped, and
right.
he kind of reverted back to form. But you're right. Right now, I don't think that Mickey Moniak is even... I can't even use the word serviceable right now. I just don't feel comfortable with him in the lineup on a daily basis.
No, he just looks lost. Is there a trade that might be out there that would make any sense?
Sure. It depends on who and how much you're willing to give up. Like we've talked about this one for a while. I'm going to ask you, any interest, if you call the Cubs up and say, we want Ian Happ and David Robertson, would you be willing to move, let's say, Logan O'Hop, your number three prospect, your number one catching prospect, Mickey Moniak, and then a low level pitching prospect?
Well, I think that would make you better.
Right. No, I agree. And that's why that's something that I would do, and I would make that move. Greg, thanks so much for the phone call. Mike, if you don't mind, if you could help us out again. Really appreciate you joining us today, Greg. 610-632-0975. Yeah, I mean, listen, if that were the proposed trade, I would make that move. I've been talking about Happ and Robertson for a long time now. If you can get Happ and Robertson, Happ, who, by the way, you would have a year of arbitration left with, you would be able to have, you know, premium negotiations with him before you let him become a restricted free agent, before he becomes an unrestricted free agent the following year. If it was Ohop, Moniak, who I think you're probably going to ask for a close to major league ready outfielder in return, and he would be kind of the bridge gap, even if you will, before some of their prospects start to make their way up, and then a double A pitcher of some sorts, not a Griff McGarry, I don't think, even high A when you go to Abel and Painter, but I think that they're probably going to ask for a pitching prospect in return to offset Robertson at some point. I mean, that's a move that I'm making 10 out of 10 times. 610-632-0975, the number to join the conversation. Dan in Norristown is back with us. We'll get to him on the other side. And then it can be you also on the other side. I know it sounds like we're just going to kind of continue the game that Pat and Andrew were playing today. I promise you, we did not call each other up before the show and hash out our show topics. So we have a Phillies-related game for FanFest tickets as well. It's a little bit different than what the guys were playing earlier today. Mike Vito producing today's show. I'm Tyler Zulli. We're broadcasting live from the Parks Race and Sportsbook here inside Chickie and Pete's in Malvern until 3 o'clock on 97.5 The Fanatic.
97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
97.5 The Fanatic.
Welcome back. 133 here on 97.5 The Fanatic. 610-632-0975, the number to join the conversation. Tyler Zulli and Mike Vito. We're here until 3 o'clock today. We are broadcasting live from the Parks Race and Sportsbook here inside Chickie and Pete's in Malvern. Come on down and say hello. Got everything you need. Got all your great food and beverages to my right. Get all your sports bets to my left. Get in on all the races that are happening right now. All the baseball throughout the day. I think there's a UFC fight tonight, too. Is there not, Mike?
Actually, I believe it's going on right now. I think it's a daytime
right now.
Card.
Really? So you know who we have to call for those winners, right?
Our very own Pat Egan.
We got to get to Pat Egan. He knows what he's talking about. I do not. I am not a UFC guy, but Pat does pretty well most of the time. Now, with that being said, I just said that on the air, which means he is 1,000% going to have a terrible card. So my bad, Pat. And anybody that listens to Pat, my fault.
I'll say thank you to Pat because he's won me a few dollars from card to card.
I am the on-air bet crusher for other people. I seem to do well for myself, but for other people, I struggle. So I'm sorry, Pat. I apologize. And Mike, I'm sorry to you if you took his advice because you're going to lose money today. Just how these things go.
I'll see if I can find the cash out option.
You might want to
save
a few.
Save what I can.
Take it right now. Run with your money. 610-632-0975 is the number to join the conversation. Really quickly, before we get to this this list of top five NBA duos, Mike, I want to ask you. Not that I believe that this is going to be the case, because I've made it very, very clear that they are not going to be players in any particular trade for a player of Juan Soto's caliber. If the Phillies were, and again, I think that they have to do their due diligence, but there's a difference between doing due diligence and legitimately being in on any one particular trade. Let me ask you, what do you think the return would be for a player of the caliber of Juan Soto?
It's going to take everybody. You're going to have to unload the farm. I have an example here. Jeff Passan put it out and said that baseball values what they do. And this is just what the Dodgers would have to give up. Catching prospect Cartaya, Gavin Lux, their starting pitching prospect May, a relief pitcher in Miller, Stone, and Vargas. And you figure Phillies aren't even on that level. So, like you said,
sure,
it's going to take Painter. It's going to take a Bell. You probably have to throw a Stott or a Moniak or a Boehm in there. Maybe even that Griff McGarry kid who just came up to Double A, but you're essentially going to have to throw the farm at it, cliche to say.
Yeah, no, I think that you're right. I'm gonna that website that you were just talking about, the baseball trade value. I'm just interested, right? Because these are the kind of things that, like, for whatever reason, super interest me. That I am like a total nerd over, and maybe that's where the name bot comes in. But I'm just curious as to what this trade would cost, and I'm gonna put just a couple of guys. Let's say I'm going to put three guys in this trade value simulator thing. And I'm only looking for three guys in specific. Of course, I'm looking for Painter. I'm looking for Abel. And I threw Alec Bohm into there as well. So that's three-player list. That is not enough in... That's not enough in trade, right?
What's their total value equal?
Their total value equals 77.1.
Yeah, you're going to need a lot more, because what I gave you from the Dodgers equals 198, and they have Soto valued at 193.
Right, so I was just trying to see what Soto's value was. That's all I wanted to do was compare.
Right.
So I gave you Abel, Painter, and Bohm, a major league ready third baseman, and the Phillies' top two prospects. Let's throw two more guys in, just to have some fun. I threw in Logan O'Hop and Mitch McGarry. Gets you to 103.4. What was Soto's value at?
193.7.
You're still 80.
You're not even in the ballpark.
And that's in a simulator that is just in value, right? Like, that's just numerical, analytical, computer-made-up value, right? And I have 103 with four of the Phillies' top... I don't know, where's McGarry at now? Probably four of the Phillies' top eight prospects. And Alec Bohm, who at one point not too long ago was one of the top Phillies prospects. You're not even in the ballpark. I don't even know if you've got a ticket. You're still scalping tickets outside like it's 1998. You got no chance. But I was just curious. I'd love to know what that value was. So realistically speaking, you have to... The unfortunate thing for the Nationals is one of two things are going to happen. Either you're not going to get the proper value for Soto that you would like, which often happens when you get a superstar on the trade block. It's just the inevitability of the situation. Or you're going to, at some point, have to take back a major league player that you're going to have to pay, even though you may not necessarily want to pay that major league player, because you have to, in some value, give to get, right? And that's why trading superstars oftentimes is unfavorable for the team that has them. We're not playing video games here. This isn't Madden, where when you make a trade in Madden, you get that bar that goes like across your screen, and it's like, oh, this is 78% of the way what we're hoping for. So you just start throwing picks in. You start adding the value of picks up. You add a different player, and eventually you make the trade happen. This is real life. And Juan Soto may be one of the five best players in baseball. So one of two things are going to happen. Either the Nationals are not going to get the return on investment that they had hoped for a player of the caliber of Juan Soto, or option two, they are going to end up kind of cornering themselves into a market that only has three or four teams in it. Because you have to think about having the value of the trade value necessary, which not every team does, and the monetary value necessary to extend him, because you're not going to trade for him and not extend him. That would be stupid. That would be totally foolish. So you're going to kind of corner yourself to a market of, I don't know, maybe three or four teams. And you've just got to pick the best value left. Are you going to pick the Dodgers, you know, cabinet even more so? You did that for Trey Turner. You got their best catching prospect and others. Are you going to continue to go down that route? I mean, it would make sense feasibly, but they don't have a lot of options. And this is why, even though, again, $440 million is an enormous amount of money. It is generational wealth. And I'm not taking that for granted. This is why when you lowball a player of his caliber, you end up more times than not on the short end. I think the Nationals messed themselves up in this trade market, or in this trade conversation, by not offering more. I'm not sure if they have more. But like we talked about earlier in the show, Mike, very realistic chance he gets a $500 million extension. And if you offer him 440 and he's like, nah, I'm good, trade me. Well, now teams know that you kind of have to trade him.
Yeah, like you said, they're backed into a corner. And you got to see, there's only a handful of teams that are going to have, you said, the prospect pool to be able to do it. But then do they have the money to do it beyond that? As you said, you're not going to trade for him and not extend
and
him.
And not extend him, right. Unless you are totally selling out for one World Series, which I don't mind. I think that there's a lot of merit to selling out for a World Series for most players. But this is not an example of that. This would be like selling out for Soto, be selling out for Otani. It would be selling out for Acuna. It'd be selling out for, you name it, right? A young
Vlad Guerrero.
Vlad Guerrero Jr., perhaps. A young player who has, you know, impending free agency coming up. Like we talked about the other day, Dan Fritz and I. What are the Angels going to do with Shohei Ohtani? Their backs are against the wall, too.
Yeah.
Because if I were him, I wouldn't want to re-sign there.
I don't know. I wouldn't. I mean, you have Trout there on his big contract. And one that didn't work out was Anthony Rendon when they signed him to that big free agent deal.
It's one
of
the worst contracts in sports right now.
They're not getting their money's worth there.
And I don't blame them for making, you know, for making the offer. Go and get your guy if you think that that's the guy. But that's bad, man. They're in a bad spot. But like that's the point. When you've got these young, you know, still having arbitration left eligibility, but they're closing in on free agency. And the reality is when you have guys like that, you're going to do everything you can to avoid those last arbitration years. Because the last thing you want to do is piss off a player by saying, we think you're worth $15 million and he thinks he's worth $20 million. And then he goes, well, because you didn't give me $5 million, I'm not going to re-sign with you next year. Listen, I did that in MLB The Show one time. And that was a video game. That's not real life. This is real life. Don't mess with people's money. So, they've put themselves in a bad spot. 610-632-0975, the number to join the conversation. All right, let's get to this NBA list. Bleacher Report put this out via Grant Hughes. This was a couple days ago, but I haven't had the opportunity to discuss it just yet. They put out their top five duos in the NBA. Now, before I even give you the list, Mike, if I had to ask you, who do you think is the number one duo in the NBA? Your opinion, not what this list said. Who would you say is the number one duo in the NBA?
I'd have to go with the champions and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, or Steph Curry and whoever else you want from the Golden State Warriors.
Not a bad one. Not on this list. Not on this top five. Now, what I'd like to do is extend this exercise to, let's pretend, again, we're going to go back to the video game analogy for a second. Let's pretend we turned injuries off. Injuries are not a thing. Would it be a fair assessment, knowing that injuries are not a thing, to put Kawhi Leonard and Paul George at the top of that list?
Absolutely.
They're number five, because injuries are a thing.
Okay.
Both of those guys missed a substantial amount of time last year.
And if you take injuries out of it, sorry, don't.
Yeah, so if you take injuries out of it, can they be number one?
Yeah, and I'll give you the one that would be the obvious number one then would be KD and Kyrie, taking injuries out of it.
Right. They're number three on this list. Number two, the reigning back-to-back MVP, Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray.
Hard to argue with that one.
Number one, Giannis Antetokounmpo and Jrue Holiday.
Hard to argue with that one. I mean, obviously they went to the second round this year and then
Won the finals the year before.
So, yeah, I mean, that's reasonable.
The reason that I skipped number four probably is obvious to you at this point. Number four on this list is Joel Embiid and James Harden. So I want to ask you, 610-632-0975, where would you rank Joel Embiid and James Harden heading into the 2022 season as a tandem compared to other duos, other tandems across the NBA? Here's my thing. This doesn't hinge on Joel Embiid. We know what Joel Embiid is. We know that he's an MVP candidate for the last two seasons. We know he probably should have been the MVP or could have been the MVP a season ago. This tandem doesn't hinge on Joel Embiid whatsoever. Think about all of these, for the most part, in this top five. The tandem hinges on one of the two. Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray. Jokic is the back-to-back MVP. The guy hardly ever misses games. it hinges on the health and the return of Jamal Murray to full strength. Same could be said, as you made mention, Mike, for number three, Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. Hinges on the health and the availability of those two guys. Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Hinges on the health of both of them. Now, it's not necessarily a health thing. It can be to an extent with the hamstring for James Harden. For me, it's a consistency thing. If James Harden is consistently where we're hoping he can be. Now, I'm not saying he has to do it every single night because, let's be honest, it's hard to do that on a consistent basis every single night. But I've used this phrase over and over and over and over again, and you're probably tired of hearing me saying it, but it's the contributable points. If he can give me 20 points, 10 assists, 18 points, 12 assists on a near nightly basis, and I can see him play, I gave 60 games played in the regular season. Tom Alvord said he wanted more than that. He wanted closer to 70. But if I can get 60 from him and 67 to 70 games from Embiid and close to the max possible from Tyrese Maxey and Tobias Harris and everybody else, I wonder where that duo sits at the end of the year. If Embiid is Embiid and Harden is consistently, you know, Brooklyn Nets Harden, the Harden that we saw, you know, from time to time with the Sixers, the Harden that statistically was there most of the year, it just felt like the bad games outweighed the good games, which statistically is false. If you can get that from Harden on a year basis, on a full year, 60 to 65 games, maybe even gets closer to 70, and Embiid plays the way that Embiid did last year, is it feasible to move them ahead of some of these pairings on this list? And if so, where do you put them? I think four is a good spot. My list doesn't go in this particular order, but I think that four is a fair spot. I think that, in fact, I think that this pairing isn't even the correct one for the number one spot. For number one, if you want to go with the Bucks, I don't know if I put them at number one, but if you want to go with the Bucks, to me the pairing is Giannis and Middleton. I love Drew Holiday. Drew Holiday is a complete guard. Great defender. People call some, often NBA players say he is the hardest guy that, one of the hardest guys to defend, one of the hardest guys to defense them. So I don't have any issue with Holiday being on this list, but Middleton comes back healthy at some point in the, you know, the middle stages, the late stages of the season. I think that that's the pairing down the stretch, assuming that Middleton's able to come back, you know, healthy. But where can Embiid and James Harden sit on this list at the end of the year? And right now, is four fair? I think it is. Mike, what about you?
Yeah, I think they can end up being probably the number two or three duo. And obviously it does. It all is going to come down to what James Harden you're going to get this year. And I want to read you a quote that he came out the other day. NBA and ESPN posted this on Instagram the other day via the Hot Time. He goes, "I'm taking this summer as an opportunity to make sure that I get back to the elite level that I know I can be at and that I will be at." Now, elite level, in his mind, I can understand. What we might be expecting is you're not going to see a 40-point James Harden probably ever again. If he's out there giving you a solid 25 a game with 8 to 10 assists and 8 to 10 rebounds a game, what more can you ask from him? And they'll put them in that echelon of maybe even the top duo come the end of the season.
I was looking for even less points than that. I could get in the 18 to 20 range. I'd, quite frankly, if he gives me 17, 18, 19 points per game, which is great, by the way, which would make him probably the second leading scorer on the team behind Embiid, with, or maybe third if Maxey, you know, gets up into the 20s for the full season again, or for the first time gets up into the full 20s for a season. I'm looking more for the playmaking. I'm looking more for the facilitation. I'm looking more for the distribution. I'm looking more for what James Harden needs to be. It is less what the Sixers need to be for James Harden, and it's more what James Harden needs to be for the Sixers. What does James Harden need to be for the Sixers to be a competent, complete NBA team? And I think that that's the playmaking James Harden. That's the facilitating James Harden. That's point guard James Harden. And that's why, to me, the assists are far more important than the points scored. Now, granted, you can make the best pass in the world, but if the guy doesn't make the shot, then it's just a great pass. But I need him to be the facilitator and the playmaker. The one tandem, really quickly, Mike, the one tandem that I'm surprised is not on this list, went to the NBA Finals last year. Any surprise to you that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are not on this top five?
Yes, that is surprising to see them not in there. And I don't even think, did they make the honorable mention?
There was no honorable mention. It was just the top five.
Okay. That's definitely shocking to see him, because you can even put Marcus Smart in there with either one of those guys. It's definitely surprising that they didn't put somebody from Boston on that list.
So here would be my top five. I think that this would be my top five, barring, you know, considering health and all that good stuff. Five would be Embiid and Harden at five. Four would be, I think I would go Giannis and Holiday at four. Again, this is barring health. I would go Giannis and Holiday at four. I'm a bigger Murray fan than most. In fact, before the cataclysmic injury, I actually picked the Denver Nuggets to win the title back-to-back years, to go to the finals back-to-back years out of the West, and obviously injuries have derailed them substantially. I think I would go Jokic and Murray. I don't know. I guess I can't. How can I leave the MVP out? If I'm putting Tatum and Brown on this list, I've got to take one of these pairs off. Which one of these pairs comes off? I don't know. I'm struggling with this. I got to think about this.
Yeah, I'm not sitting here just ignoring it. I'm sitting here in silence trying to figure it out myself.
I'm literally struggling, because I think that Brown and Tatum belong on this list. But I don't know who to take off. Because, again, if everything is equal and health is an equal factor...
I think, honestly...
I think I put Kawhi and George at one, if health is, you know, equal.
I don't have an argument with that. I think the one you'd probably take out, because they're not going to be together, is Kyrie and KD, most likely.
If they are together and they're healthy and they can play a full season...
It's hard not to make them one.
They're one or two. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
I don't know what the situation is. So I can only go off of what I know. And what I know is availability. What I know is you know, returning health. What I know is guys who are battling back from injuries. What I know is these two guys are assuredly going to be on their team next year. I don't know if that's the case for KD and Kyrie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the case for health-wise for Kawhi and George. I got to think about this on the other side. It's a good think piece. And by the way, I've got an hour left to take this fly out.
He's still getting you?
It's terrible, dude. He's landing on me. He's landing on everybody here. Landing on my pen.
Hopefully, you're protecting your food.
Our computer. Good thing we don't have any food here. Everything that's drinkable has a lid on it. But this is getting brutal. So yes, I want to ask you 610-632-0975. Joel Embiid and James Harden, according to Bleacher Report, according to Grant Hughes, he ranks them as the fourth best duo, the fourth best tandem in the NBA heading into this season. Above them, Giannis and Holiday at one, Jokic and Murray at two, KD and Kyrie at three. The one below them is Kawhi and Paul George at five. And I guess Tatum and Brown would be six. Then the question becomes, if one of these guys is healthy, where do you put Anthony Davis and LeBron in that list? A lot of good duos.
And the champs.
Who do you put in the top five? And where are Embiid and James Harden? That's Mike Vito. I'm Tyler Zulli. We broadcast live from the Parks Race and Sportsbook here inside Chickie and Pete's in Malvern. We're here for another hour. We take you until 3 o'clock on 97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.